From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, true ghost stories. Here's what's happening. Well, you're not going to believe this, but another building went down. This one was being partially constructed in Washington, D.C. A five-story building under construction collapsed today, leaving several people injured, including one man who was trapped in the rubble for more than an hour, but great firefighters rescued him. Four people were immediately helped out of the collapsed building. My gosh. Meanwhile, in Florida, officials are considering demolishing the rest of the Champlain Towers South building that went down as operations continue in sections that crumbled to the ground a week ago. 18 people dead, 149 still missing there. The Trump Organization and its chief financial officer have pleaded not guilty in a Manhattan court after being charged with fraud in tax crimes. The longtime CFO pleaded not guilty to grand larceny. The former president's family business also pleaded not guilty to tax-related crimes, which included a scheme to defraud. We'll see how this unfolds. Well, a lot of people are buying cryptocurrencies these days, but is that the smart thing to do when you have precious metals out there like gold and silver as well? Philip Patrick is a specialist with the Birch Gold Group, one of our new clients, by the way. Philip, what do you think of cryptocurrencies compared to gold and silver?
I mean, I would put them, quite frankly, on opposite ends of the spectrum, right? You look at cryptocurrencies, it's an interesting concept, certainly, and I think it will sustain, but I think there are issues there, governmental regulation, ultimately, things like that. It looks speculative, right? It's an interesting idea, could do very well, but could go the other way. And I would put, as I mentioned, gold on the other end of the spectrum. This is something that has thousands of years of history. It's a wealth preserver. So I would view them very differently.
Philip, do you ever see us going back to the gold standard we were on at once?
Listen, it would be a very good thing, I think, for the United States. Look at what's happening with our currency today. We have a Federal Reserve printing the dollar into oblivion. A gold standard didn't allow for that. Will it happen? I think it'll be tough, right? You know, what that would require is legislators to ultimately vote to tie their hands behind their back, right? These guys like to overspend. They like to kick the can further down the road, and this wouldn't allow them to do it. So I think it would be a great thing. How likely it is, it's hard to say, certainly with this administration.
What are your projections for gold and silver over the next couple of years?
Listen, I think the climate that we are in is about the most conducive that we've seen, right? We have a huge amount of national debt. We've got a stock market currently 2.5 years into the longest bull run in recorded history. We have correction on the horizon. I tend to defer. Bank of America came out quite recently with a prediction. They see gold at 3,000 an ounce within the next year or so.
Wow.
That seems to ring true to me.
That's a huge jump, isn't it?
It is. We're you know, in the 1700s, the high 1700s today. There's certainly some scope for growth there.
Philip, thank you for being on the show. Keep in touch with us. Philip Patrick from the Birch Gold Group. Reports of vehicle break-ins in San Francisco up between 100% and over 750% in parts of the Golden City, according to the police department's most recent monthly statistics. The number of thefts from vehicles reported citywide just in the month of May more than doubled from 923 in 2020 to 1,891 the same month in 2021. People are just breaking into cars to steal things. They say eating more potatoes and baked French fries help control blood pressure, and it's good for you. So just remember that. French fries aren't as bad as people say these days. Enjoy. If you're a morning person, you may be at reduced risk for major depression, according to a new study. Several studies of the body's circadian sleep cycle have shown that being an early bird is associated with a lower risk of depression. Why? Let's check in with resident psychiatrist Dr. Peter Breggin. Peter, why is this the case?
Well, first of all, we have the usual problem. This is a study of 800 people. It's statistics, not people. It's genetic theories, and they're even using psychiatric diagnoses as their guidelines. But I think it's a good topic because, I mean, it's 10 after 1 right now. where I am, George.
Where you
1
are,
1 a.m.
Yeah.
What am I doing at 1 a.m.?
You're waiting for us. That's why.
I'm excited. I'm happy. I'm not depressed. I'm a night owl.
So and we have a lot of night owls. Trust me.
And we've got an audience full of night owls. And I think that that's the kind of thing I want to address, which is, you know, if you're a night owl, try to build your life around being a night owl, because it can be very stressing and very difficult to be a night owl and be a high school student or an elementary school student, and they're getting you up hours ahead of when you would ever want to. Or if you're an older, you know, person and you're still a night owl, and it can be very, very hard. So that's one place where there may be some truth to this, because night owls are trying to fit into an early bird society. But I built my life around being a night owl, and
me too.
I think that's my message for people is, you know, find out who you are and what your needs are, the directions you want to go in, what your body rhythms are, what you want in the way of love, and really, you know, make a life around it. I've made a life around being a night owl.
I love these studies and getting your reaction to it. Dr. Peter Breggin, his website, Breggin, BREGGIN.com. Up next, toxic legacy, how the weed killer glyphosate is destroying our health and the environment. Next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Stephanie Seneff with us. PhD is a senior research scientist at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. She has a bachelor's degree in biology with a minor in food and nutrition, a master's degree, an engineer's degree, and a PhD in electrical engineering and computer science, all from MIT, great school. She has authored more than 36 peer-reviewed journal papers on topics relating to human disease, to nutritional deficiencies, and toxic exposures. She is focused specifically on the herbicide glyphosate and the mineral sulfur. Her book is called Toxic Legacy. Stephanie, welcome to the program. First time for you, I understand.
Yes, thanks so much for having me.
How did you end up keying in on glyphosate all of a sudden?
It's an interesting story, and it was pretty all of a sudden, actually. I was worried about autism. It was really back in 2007 time frame. I was watching the autism rates go up. I was noticing that the government didn't seem to care too much, and, you know, they were saying we're just diagnosing it more, and I suspected there was something in the environment that was causing the increase. And I wanted to figure out what it was because, you know, most of the money was going towards genetics and, you know, their genetic predisposition, but it's not the cause of the epidemic. It has to be something in the environment. And so I looked for 5 years. I read a lot of papers on autism, so I understood a lot more about the complex, you know, disease that it is. It's a condition with many issues with the gut and
right.
mineral imbalances and, you know, brain inflammation. I mean, lots of different things going on with autism, and I wasn't able to find something in the environment that matched. So I was kind of frustrated. I was looking for something that was also going up dramatically. And it was just by chance. I happened to be at a conference where Professor Don Huber, who's a retired professor from Purdue University, expert in plant physiology and plant pathology, and he gave a two-hour presentation at a conference where I was. And it was on this thing, glyphosate, and I didn't know what glyphosate was. This was in 2012. I really didn't know what it was. I mean, of course, I knew what Roundup was. If people know Roundup.
Oh, yeah, the weed killer. Yeah.
In your yard. Yeah, get rid of all the grass growing in your cracks in your walkway. Really, really safe, you know. The government loves it, and the U.S. uses more per capita than any other country in the world. You know, we consume 4% of the world's population, 20% of the world's glyphosate. So we get a lot more glyphosate exposure here in this country. And because the government thinks it's super, super safe, it's not regulated, it's not tested in the food, you know, it's just like this stuff is great. And so Don Huber showed otherwise. When he gave that talk, he was talking about how it disrupts the soil bacteria and messes up the nutrient uptake into the plants, disrupts the gut bacteria the same way. And you get overgrowth of pathogens, you get leaky gut, you get inflammatory gut, you get bowel issues. I mean, all these gut problems that these autistic kids had, he showed it was caused by glyphosate. And then the mineral, glyphosate being a mineral chelator, is grabbing onto the important minerals like, you know, manganese and zinc and iron and cobalt, all those minerals that we need in very small amounts that are really important as catalysts for our proteins. And glyphosate basically messes up the whole system. that the body has put in place to get those minerals where they need to be safely and then to get them used by the enzymes to do their jobs. So all of that got really messed up badly by the glyphosate in the plants and in us. And, of course, in all the animals of the world, too, the insects, you know, the bees and the butterflies are dying off, and we don't know why. Of course, we attribute it to insecticides. For example, the bees, chlorpyrifos, I think it's true. Chlorpyrifos is a very important contributor to the bee problem. But glyphosate is also a major player, and we don't think about it because it's so safe. It's supposed to be safe, very great, because it kills all weeds. It kills all plants, actually, except for those that have been engineered through genetic engineering to resist it. But it's completely harmless to humans. So that's sort of hard to believe because, you know, there's a lot of commonality.
Oh, a lot of lawsuits, too, out there.
Physiology.
Stephanie, the beer company, which bought Monsanto, probably bought them at the wrong time, has set aside $10 billion for potential settlements because of all of this. I mean,
right.
Unbelievable.
It was way too little, right? It was way too little. I mean, they actually, you know, they got into big trouble. Really, as soon as it got taken over by Bayer was when trouble started happening. And I have a feeling the Monsanto executives saw it coming, and they unloaded it for that reason.
I think you're right.
No, but, you know, it seems likely because, and they, Monsanto was very good at fighting against anyone who would claim that glyphosate caused their cancer. And it was just, I was so excited when, I think that was 2016 maybe, when the first person who won the award, he had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma at a young age. He was in his 40s. He applied glyphosate to schoolyards, which just really breaks my heart to think of the schoolyards having glyphosate.
Oh, my God,
them.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so it was, he didn't use any other chemicals, and he had this at an early age, and he was dying of it, and it was just a really good case. And so they ended up winning by a huge amount through a jury trial, with a lot of the money being, you know, because of Monsanto's misbehavior, as punishing, you know, for their misbehavior, the way they dealt with the product and the way they...
And there have been other suits, too.
Other suits after that, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, his name was Dwayne Lee Johnson, the guy. Dwayne Lee Johnson was his name. And then there were two more lawsuits after that. One of them involved a couple. Both of them had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and each of them was really big in the news, and every one of them was a jury trial, and each one won huge amounts of money. And, of course, it went into Monsanto contested it. So it went into higher courts. They're still fussing around. I don't think they've gotten their money yet, you know. And, of course, it was the number was reduced by the judge and this kind of thing.
Sure, but it's still a lot of money, though.
Right, but it really woke people up. And I think it was really because of that that people started to take a second look at glyphosate and think maybe this stuff is not so safe after all.
By the way, how does a weed killer...
I don't know, tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands. Huge numbers of people are coming forward with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, just that one disease, and saying, you know, so there's big class action lawsuits going on, and they're trying to negotiate a deal. I have a hard time keeping up with it because it seems to keep changing. It's something like $11 billion. Was the goal to pay off all these, you know, people in a large class action lawsuit and then get off the hook for future cancer. And that's where the lawyers backed down and said, no, we can't do that. And they were going to set up a committee, do a study, and prove for all time that glyphosate, that either that it does or that it doesn't. Of course, they would stack the deck and prove that it doesn't cause cancer, and then nobody would be able to sue them anymore. This was kind of, I think, Monsanto's plan or Bayer's plan. But it kind of didn't work because the lawyers fought back, so they saw through what they were trying to do. So I think it's still in negotiation, but there's a huge number of people now who are claiming that glyphosate caused their non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Well, and it might have. Now, how does a weed killer determine to kill the weed and not the plant it's supposed to protect? How does it make that distinction?
Isn't it?
It is. Yeah. How does that work?
It's amazing technology, actually. I have to give them credit for that. These guys are doing pretty sophisticated stuff with their gene editing, you know? And so this is, you know, genetic engineering. You know, you talk GMOs, right? You hear a lot about GMOs. In fact, I think people were fighting GMO technology long before they were fighting glyphosate. I think many of those people who were against GMOs, they were more against the genetic engineering without really being aware that one of the big problems with the GMOs is that they were enabling the glyphosate to get all over the food supply. People weren't really picking up on that, you know. Now they are. I think people are much more aware of that. But because... You basically, so glyphosate has been shown to severely affect a particular enzyme in plants called EPSP synthase, and it's an enzyme in a biological pathway called the shikimate pathway. And the claim that makes glyphosate, makes people so happy about glyphosate, is that human cells don't have that enzyme. They don't even have that pathway. So it's kind of like, how could it possibly affect us, because our cells, you know, don't have the enzyme that it disturbs? And that's the argument. And so these plants have that pathway, and it's absolutely essential. They die without, if it's not functioning, they die. But there were they found these microbes that had a different version of that enzyme that was not sensitive to glyphosate. So they basically took that enzyme from the microbe, and they stuck it into the plant using this GMO technology. It's pretty amazing what they can do. They stick a gene into the plant's actual genome to give it the power to make a version of the enzyme that's insensitive to glyphosate. And that did the trick. And then the plants were able to continue to grow with glyphosate sprayed all over them. So you could just spray it out of the airplane all over the crop. And, of course, the weed side of the crop thrives. Very efficient.
But we end up eating it from the crops, don't we? Because
it's
residual.
Get higher levels into our residuals into our food. And the other thing that's happened, people don't realize this either, is that they started, it was a little bit later, the GMO technology came about in the late 1990s, and the use of glyphosate on crops grew exponentially during the 10 years, 2000 to 2010 timeframe. It grew exponentially, along with the exponential growth in autism. Two curves coincide. So, you know, very strong correlation between the growth in glyphosate usage on core crops and the growth in the number of kids who have autism in this country. And people say, well, correlation doesn't mean causation, ha, ha, ha. I mean, they basically ignore it. I don't ignore it. I think it's quite stunning. And, you know, correlation alone is not enough to say, oh, this caused that. But if you can find a causal mechanism, then it becomes much more powerful as an argument. You know?
Would you say that Toxic Legacy, your book, truly points out the dangers of glyphosate?
Absolutely. I have lots and lots of references in there, and I really dug through the research literature. And the nice thing that's happening, I can give a bit of a story here because...
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, back in the early days when they were getting the approval, they used mostly high levels of glyphosate in their tests to test toxicity. And they also only studied it for a short time period. Like, they would do animal studies, and they would expose the animals for, say, 3 months. And they had a rule that if you didn't see any damage by 3 months, you were good to go. You know, glyphosate is a slow kill, so they very strategically stopped studying it at the moment when it would have started to show damage. And so both the idea of low, there was this concept that dose makes the poison. And so if it's, they had this rule that if it doesn't seem to be toxic at a higher dose, you don't have to test it at a lower dose. That was strategic, too, because I think they knew probably even then that at low doses, glyphosate starts to do strange things that you don't see at higher doses. This is what you call an endocrine disruptor. It's a classic aspect, characteristic of an endocrine disruptor, and there are many of them in our environment, like the plastics are endocrine disruptors. They are much more toxic at low doses than they are at higher doses. They never studied it at the low doses, so they didn't find that. And they also didn't find the slow kill aspect either. This guy, Seralini, was a real hero because he's in France, and he had a team there, and they did a study, and that actually was published right around the time that I learned about glyphosate from Don Huber. There was a paper. It was really, I think, maybe the first paper that I read after I got back and started looking into glyphosate in more detail. I came across this paper by Seralini, which was an amazing paper because they exposed rats to glyphosate at low levels, and they did it over below regulatory limits, and they did it over their entire lifespan. And they set up an experiment that was very similar to one that had been done by Monsanto for the approval process, only they went beyond the 3 months. They went to 4 months, they went to the whole lifespan. And they found that 3 months, things were looking good, but by 4 months, they started to see some problems showing up in the exposed animals. And by the time they finished the experiment, the female rats had massive mammary tumors, the male rats had kidney damage and liver damage, and all the rats had problems with reproduction. So it was, and then they had a early death. They had a shortened lifespan. So Seralini showed very dramatically in that paper that glyphosate is toxic, you know, at doses that we could potentially be exposed to. And I think that was 2012. That paper got retracted after pressure from the industry for ridiculous reasons. It was not justified to retract it. And then it got republished. Another journal jumped right on it and republished the study shortly thereafter. So it's still valid. It's a study. It's a legitimate publication at this point. And it really changed the way the research was done, because before that time, you know, researchers who do toxicology studies, they're like, well, I'm not going to study a chemical that's known to be safe. It's just pointless. I'm going to waste my money, right? So they didn't bother. But once he showed them that this was happening, many studies started showing up, and they're actually showing up in greater frequency in recent times. Just over the past couple of years, there have been a number of amazing studies that have all been low-dose glyphosate. So
hold on for a second, Stephanie. We're at a break. We're going to come back. We'll talk more about your work, Toxic Legacy, on Coast to Coast AM. We'll take your calls next hour with Stephanie Seneff as we talk about her work, Toxic Legacy. If you have played around with Roundup or something like that, check in with us or just use a question or two, and we'll put you right on the program. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Dr. Stephanie Seneff with us. Her book is called Toxic Legacy. Stephanie, when glyphosate is sprayed, how long does it stay? How long does it last?
No, that's an excellent question. And the story that Monsanto gave us was that it just disappears very quickly, that after a couple of weeks, it's mostly gone from the soil. That turns out not to be true. I mean, when people started looking experimentally, they found under various conditions, some conditions it can break down fast, but there are other conditions in which it will stick around for a long time. And one study showed that when it gets out into the ocean, it gets down below where you get sunlight penetration, because sunlight will break it down. But when it gets dark, you can stick around for over a year in the ocean. A study on trees, a very recent study on trees up in northern Canada, and they found that they looked 12 years later after they had applied glyphosate into the forest, and these trees still had significant amounts of glyphosate in them, in their tissues, 12 years later. It's accumulating in our body as well, and this is another thing that Monsanto likes to deny, but their own study showed that, and I talk about that in my book, that they did a study on bluegill sunfish way back when, like I think in the 1980s, and they used radio-labeled glyphosate so they could trace the label. And they found the radio label in the tissue samples that they took. And then when they tried to measure the glyphosate, they found out that there was only about maybe 20% of the label could be accounted for as glyphosate. The rest of it was kind of mysterious. And then they found if they broke down the proteins, this is very significant, actually, if they broke the proteins down into individual amino acids, they recovered 70% of the glyphosate. So they got a lot of the glyphosate free from the protein through these enzymes. So they then concluded that it had gone into the tissue and perhaps it was incorporated into the protein. This was their words. And that is exactly a key message from my book, that glyphosate gets incorporated into proteins by mistake in place of the amino acid glycine, which is an analog of, and that this causes proteins to misbehave. And that is so central to its toxicity, in my opinion. And it gets into all of our tissues. It accumulates over time. It disrupts many of our proteins. And that causes many, many diseases. So that's why we have many diseases that are going up. It's not just autism. I started looking, and I'm finding very great correlations between glyphosate and obesity, diabetes, Alzheimer's, various cancers, thyroid cancer, pancreatic cancer. Of course, you've got the lymphomas, the blood cancers, and various good digestive problems like inflammatory gut. These are all going up dramatically in our population, in step with a dramatic rise in the use of glyphosate on corn crops over time. So I think you see the correlations, and then for me that gives me a mystery of how is it that glyphosate could cause this disease. And then I look into the various proteins and which ones would be more likely to be affected in this way of getting glyphosate into the protein and how that would affect it. So the book is kind of a mystery story of how to figure out, how did glyphosate cause the diseases that are correlated with it? How could it cause them? What would be the biological explanation? And a lot of it relates to disturbing the proteins.
Now, once glyphosate is on the plant, does it get into the plant physically?
It does. It gets into the plant tissue. It gets into the, the bee tissue.
Oh,
it gets
boy.
Into the human tissue. It gets
so you can't just wash it off. You get stuck eating
can't.
It.
That's an important point. It's embedded in the protein even. So, and this is why I think we have an epidemic in gluten intolerance, and that's one of the ones that, is going up in step with glyphosate. It actually matches very well with glyphosate use on wheat, which is not surprising because wheat, it has the protein, gluten, that is the problem with gluten intolerance. We have huge sections of the grocery stores these days that are devoted to selling gluten-free foods.
Yes.
And, people have a celiac disease, but other people just have sensitivity without an actual diagnosis of celiac disease. And the problem is that glyphosate, I believe, is getting incorporated into the gluten protein itself. Glyphosate is also getting incorporated into proteins that are needed to digest wheat. So we have a problem with protein digestion because of glyphosate. Proteins don't get properly digested. You end up with fragments of the protein that are still stuck together. The amino acids are not broken apart. You know, proteins are like beads on a string. They're sequences of amino acids that are formed one after the other in the according to the DNA code. This is basic stuff in biology. When the code sees a code for glycine, it picks up glyphosate by mistake and sticks it into the protein. This is what I argue is happening. It's a central thesis in my book, and it's central to the reason why glyphosate could be causing all of these diseases that are going up dramatically.
Oh, my God, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's an epidemic. Why can't we get it banned?
Well, that's a good question. The government thinks it's safe, so there's no point. And, of course, it makes the agriculture cheap, and so we get cheap food, and we love that. So people don't realize how important it is to spend the extra money to buy organic. And I'll tell you, once I realized, you know, what, not 2012, it wasn't it was no more than a few months after I discovered glyphosate that my family went completely organic. We even threw away everything we had that wasn't organic. We did a purge. And now we've been just only buying certified organic food.
And what's wrong, Stephanie, with eating an occasional weed once in a while?
Well, not a weed that's been sprayed with glyphosate.
No.
Right. I know. But
if we didn't spray our fields at all with this stuff, what would happen?
Well, I know. That's a good question, because I don't actually know enough about farming to know if the wheat field would be in trouble with the way you would harvest the wheat and whether you'd get a lot of extra stuff in there from the, you know, from the weeds that would mess up the purity of the product. I don't know what the issue would be there. I think it's mostly about efficient, you know, yields. How much yield can you get? And when you have the weeds competing for the resources, they take away from the yield. And that's the big thing they look for in crops. How much yield did you get? And in fact, you know, they were expecting glyphosate to greatly improve the yield. And what happened was that was true for the first couple of years. After they introduced these GMO crops, they took over very quickly. But they discovered that as years went on, the glyphosate was really messing up the soil. It messes up the soil bacteria. It messes up the soil minerals, you know, and it messes up the uptake even of things like nitrogen and sulfur into the plant. So the plant started to get sick, you know, the soil was being ruined by the glyphosate year by year. And the plants were getting less and less robust, and they're getting more sensitive to infections, too, with fungus and things like that. So the yield was really good the first couple of years, and then it started to slip. And by the time, you know, by 10 years, it wasn't so clear that glyphosate was actually a win, you know. So they started off with a bang, and then it kind of disintegrated year by year. And I think once they got into the sort of habit of having the glyphosate, it was hard for them to break that habit.
Is Roundup sold worldwide, do you know?
I think it pretty much is. I mean, there are certainly countries that use a huge amount less than other countries, and that's quite interesting to look at because you see that I have identified a correlation with COVID-19. I found that quite fascinating because I feel the countries that use a lot of glyphosate are getting really hit hard by COVID-19, and the countries that use very little glyphosate are practically immune to it. And, you know, I can give Bhutan as an example, Bhutan. Bhutan is a small country up in the Himalayas. Very little glyphosate, mostly with small organic farms, and that's the food that they eat. Very little processed foods as well, because there are other issues with processed foods besides the glyphosate. But these people are eating healthy food from, you know, small family farms, and they have practically zero deaths from COVID-19 and practically no cases. So they basically are immune to it. Whereas here we've got such a fight, we just can't get ahead of this, you know, this disease. We're so frustrated. Brazil is having a really hard time, and they've got these new variants coming out of South Africa and Brazil and UK. Those are all countries that use a lot of glyphosate. And, in fact, South Africa is hit the hardest among the African countries, and they're the one that has a lot of GMO Roundup Ready maize. They grow a lot of GMO crops in South Africa. So it's really quite an interesting pattern when you look around the world at the countries that are having a hard time controlling COVID. They're the same countries that are using a lot of glyphosate. And I think there's a good reason for that. And, in fact, I have a whole chapter in my book on the immune system, and I showed how glyphosate can be expected to disrupt innate immunity, which makes your lungs unable to clear the virus when you get an infection. They can't get rid of the virus. It starts multiplying. It takes over. And then you get this extreme reaction. It's an overreaction of the immune system with what they call a cytokine storm that really kind of wrecks the tissues trying to kill off the virus. And I believe that's a consequence of chronic glyphosate exposure, that the immune system is too weak to control the virus.
There are a handful of states, Stephanie, that have banned Roundup and the use of it.
Well, not whole states. Oh, you mean countries around the world?
States. Some states have. California's fighting it.
They are not totally banned, but California's done a good job. They've got several cities and counties, I think, even that have restricted, you know, banned glyphosate usage on public spaces or like in schoolyards. Hawaii banned it in schoolyards. There's, you know, lots of individual cities. In Connecticut, there's, you know, at least one city that's banned it in, for use on the public spaces. It's sort of a spotty thing across the country. Growing awareness and a lot of activity going on at the local level, which is fantastic. I think we need to encourage people to do that because individuals can do that at their local. I mean, they're going to care about their schoolyards, for example, to get their local schoolyard, you know, make sure there's no glyphosate.
Oh, my God, the kids playing with it.
A mother to do, you know. There are countries, and one that I'm really, really excited about is Mexico. And I don't know if you've heard this, but Mexico has decided they're going to get rid of glyphosate by 2024. They're going to phase it out to zero by 2024.
Germany's doing the same thing.
Pardon?
Germany's doing the same thing.
Germany is too. You're right. In Austria. Austria tried to ban it outright, and then they got into some kind of trouble with the European Union. I mean, they do this, you know. There's a lot of political stuff that goes on that says, oh, you didn't quite follow the rules, you didn't do it right, and therefore, you know, loophole type of stuff that forced Austria ended up backing down, which really frustrated me. But Germany, France, and Austria have all been making steps in the right direction, but not quite, you know, fully acting on them. I'm really looking at Mexico, and the United States has been pressuring Mexico, saying this is crazy, you can't do this, you know, we're gonna fight back, right? The United States is going to fight back. They hate that Mexico is doing this, which just infuriates me. I mean, this country should really follow.
We should be the leader. There's too much money involved in it. Now, what about the home gardener, Stephanie, who, you know, has a little spray can of Roundup and, you know, is playing in his tomato patch and stuff like that? Could he possibly
terrible.
Come down with cancer or something like that?
I absolutely think so. His kids could end up with autism. I definitely would be very worried if you were using Roundup on tomatoes that you were feeding to your children. It would be very bad, or especially to, you know, pregnant women.
Oh,
pregnant woman eating tomatoes contaminated with glyphosate would not be a good thing.
You know, I go back and forth between L.A. and St. Louis, and Monsanto is based in St. Louis.
That's right. You get up close and personal,
I know. I knew a lot of people at Monsanto back in the 80s, and they, you know, built the Life Science Center there and everything else, and everybody was talking about, we're going to genetically alter plants and do this and that. And everybody thought, whoa, this is fantastic, a new science,
right.
It's something like that.
But I know. It's amazing science, actually, but it's quite frightening. And we don't even really understand the GMO technology, whether that's dangerous in and of itself. We don't really. I don't know. I'm agnostic on that. But it's very clear to me the chemicals are, and the GMO technology enables the use of the chemicals. And that, I think, is central to one thing that is bad about them, is that you end up with a lot more chemicals in your food, especially glyphosate, when you have these GMO glyphosate-resistant crops.
Well, Monsanto started off as a chemical company and then evolved into some of the seeds and crops and things like that. But originally, they were there for chemicals. And did they not patent glyphosate in 1968?
You're right. 1968, they patented it as a weed killer. It was patented before that by Stouffer's, I think, which was a chemical company in 1961, as a metal cleaning metal pipes because it strips metal off of pipes. That's its action as a chelator. It's a fantastic metal chelator. It binds really tightly to metals, and that's a reason why it disrupts the minerals in the gut and in the soil.
It was an antibiotic too, wasn't it?
It is. It was patented as an antibiotic in 2010.
People would actually ingest this thing that way?
Well, it's interesting. They've actually kind of gotten around to sort of proposing it's a possible thing you could use to treat some of these microbial infections like pathogens. I don't know that anyone has actually taken glyphosate. It would be such a horrendous thing to think about, but I think they have actually imagined that that could be done.
Is it on the market as an oral antibiotic?
I don't think so. There's a patent, so it's waiting for something to happen.
Yeah, it's approved for it. But
yeah, exactly. And the unfortunate thing is that it kills off the beneficial bacteria preferentially. That's one of the things I talk about in my book. I have a whole chapter on the gut, and that was a hard chapter to write. I really read a ton of papers, and they're so hard. I mean, you can't imagine these papers they write on the gut. They're so complicated. Because, you know, the gut microbiome is incredibly complex, and they have these tools that are able to look in great detail at what, you know, which microbes are there and what numbers and everything and associated with which diseases. It's just like incredibly complicated. But I did manage to dig out, a quite a good story that shows how glyphosate actually disrupts the gut, and it's shown experimentally that it kills off, you know, two really important microbes, the bifidobacteria and the lactobacillus. Those are the ones that the infant needs in great numbers to digest breast milk. And so when those microbes are killed off, it becomes hard for the infant to digest its food. And it gets sensitivities to milkness, but gets put on soy formula, and that's got a lot of glyphosate in it, so it's sort of downhill from there. But it messes up the production of these short-chain fatty acids by the microbes in the lower gut, and the balance of those is really, really important for the gut health. So you end up with the gut lining becoming sick because it's not getting the proper nutrition.
Unbelievable what they're doing to us, Stephanie. We're going to come back and take an hour phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.